We'll resume the hearing, thank you. Ms. collect yourself. I'd pose to you the question I put to Mr. Withman. It seemed to me that you and Ms. Mousoff were looking at different halves of the same hillside and forming different views because those two halves are different. Either side of the shoulder, as we discussed this morning, and put that in context, we entered your client's property from the lakeside, and we were sitting down there trying to figure out where the, looking up at the Stony Creek fan, trying to figure out where the proposed plan O&L line was, and we, the aid of the GPS, we thought, well, it was somewhere around the middle of the shelter belt, but it was impossible to see on the land. And then we went the other side of the trees and said, well, it's perfectly obvious on the other side. And so, as I want to give you the opportunity to comment that, as I say, it just seems to me it's not a meeting of minds. You're commenting on one half of the landscape and Ms. Mousoff's commenting on the other half.
Okay, my assessment, I started by defining landscape character areas, as I've already talked about, and I identified the rural parts of the Alpha Fan to be one landscape character area. So I did not see the river truncated terrace, the river formed terrace, as being a boundary to any landscape character area. So that I am putting the boundary between landscape character areas as opposed to following landforms, is what Ms. Mousoff has, that's sort of the method behind her judgment where the O&L line should go. So in my methodology of describing landscape character areas, the terrace landform became irrelevant to me.
Thank you.
Do you mind if I just go back to a question that was asked?
Certainly, but if you feel there's something to add that will assist us, we're in an information gathering mode, and any contributions are welcome.
That was the last question that Commissioner McLeod had asked me before, and that was, on further thought of the pretext to your question, I didn't answer quite as I wanted, but I've given that some more thought, because what I answered was more of a question of did I think further development in the area that I defined on that photo, did I think rural lifestyle development would be conspicuous in that location? And that was where I talked about Ruby Ridge providing a context in which I thought that it wouldn't, and also the fact that we can effectively merge dwellings within the landscape quite well in that landscape. So that was the answer to that question. But your question, I understand, was more talking about the landscape and the area of the Alpha Fan, and did I think that was conspicuous from that location? Is that was
pretty much it.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, in that particular view, the fact that that is a perfectly framed landscape that is right in the middle of the view and everything, yes, it is a conspicuous piece of landscape. And I also will clarify that I have, I agree that landscape is visually prominent from areas around Wanaka, including this one.
Yep.
But in meeting outstanding criteria, being conspicuous is one thing, but being distinctive and unique within the region is another. And so whilst it may be a conspicuous piece of landscape, and I'd imagine that's exactly why we're having this discussion now, is because it is socially prominent. But does that mean it should be an ONL? That's more the question. I believe it doesn't have the characteristics of an ONL.
Yep. Yes, it's exactly why we have these meetings, these discussions, these lawyers.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm not, just for me, it was never, I'm not 100% sure, and that's helpful, but whether it is conspicuous or conspicuous in terms, and that's something that Mrs. Melsop addresses, is in, on its own, or conspicuous in combination with. And there was some of the, like that particular zone A, I think it is, sorry, area A, is. There's lots of discussion about having the driveways concealed or in such a way. So there's obviously, it's a very sensitive area. It's seen, perceived to be a sensitive area. And it was then, and if you actually look at it in the context of that photograph, to my untrained eye, it all blends into the same. Sort of thing.
Well, and that is exactly another thing. You know, the landscape that is identified in Area A is not within the ONL, and yet it blends with the upper terrace.
Mm. And that gets on to a further point, which was the point that was made about not being necessarily an expert witness to define an ONL. And it's a conversation I have quite regularly about the majority of our visitors would arrive in Wanaka at the lakefront, and for them, walking from the bus stop to Eden Point is a wilderness experience. So it's the perception of who those, and that was something, because it was in, I can't remember, four, I think it was, we talked about the, and just, and not wanting to be the pernickety Grinch, but the paragraph headings go from 9.5, 9.6, so 9.9 to 9.1 again.
Sorry.
And it's, I think that was possibly meant to be 9.10, which was 9.11, 12.
Mr. Dan is the train spotter contribution.
Yeah, I apologise for that. I've done my... I won't go into any spelling mistakes. I guarantee why they might not.
Following the commissioner's questions, in relation to photographs taken from there, can you point out to me where Ruby Ridge is? You just need to describe it.
Sorry, and photograph 8. Okay, so, yeah, Ruby Ridge, if you were to draw a line to the left of where I've identified Area A,
yeah,
you can start to see some of the top of Ruby Ridge in the development. You would just go straight across.
Oh, yes, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
So, the way the Ridge is right. So, east of Area A.
That's right.
The paragraph I was talking about was 9.4, and this is the true 9.4 under geomorphology when you make a point of Miss Lucas, to my knowledge, is not an expert geologist or a geomorphologist, which is why we have Mr. Levy, who gave us an excellent presentation before. But I just, on your understanding of, you don't actually have to be an expert to look at an ONL or to be involved in defining an ONL now. So does that point contradict that fact?
No, I don't think it does. I think geology is just one factor we're looking at here. I haven't done a public survey to get the information, but I would imagine a lot of people would associate that landscape. They would call it a farm. They would call it, you know, and they would distinguish between a mountainside and a pastoral farm. They probably wouldn't talk about geology in most cases.
But if you were going through rural Tuscany and looking at vines that were planted by Julius Caesar, you know, essentially that is a pastoral farm, but it's also part of the ONL. Does that not make sense? You can modify, and that's a discussion. No, but that's a discussion as to how you can modify the landscape and it's still being classified as something.
Yes, and I think, well, the Mackenzie Basin is a very good example of that as well. There was a lot of discussion about that being modified landscape, and yet it's still classified as an ONL. And I think that's where the discussion of scale comes into it. And you've talked previously about, you know, questioning whether the Cadrona Valley floor, you know, that modified to an extent, but included within ONL. And on that discussion, I think this site is quite different because it exists in an urban context in most views. You've got urban development in the foreground of it, and it is not encompassed by ONL on all sides. In fact, we've got ONL to one side. And so in a lot of cases, and this Nelson also refers to the Tarkin Bay case, where a similar sort of thing happened, where quite a modified part of the valley floor was included within the ONL. Again, it was a matter of scale. That's what it came down to. And how the wider ONL was appreciated. In this case, by not including the upper face within the ONL, the upper fan within the ONL of the upper face, it's not degrading from the ONL of the upper face or the entire mountain range. It's on an urban fringe, so it quite happily sits outside the ONL.
One further point of clarification, if you would, can you please entertain, and this is 9.4 of your covenants, and I'm going to be granted again, say 9.4b, because it's the second 9.4.
That
makes sense. In your evidence in chief. When it talks about
there are lots of.
Lots of resetting going on. It starts with the second statement of the court to be somewhat unreasonable, which
right.
Mr. Monroe.
Sure.
And it's unreasonable to assume that the landowner will ever abandon the land or revert to even less intensive farming practices. In your opinion, would it be transferring the land to rural residential and rural, isn't that abandoning the land in some form?
Going back to, well, it, so abandoning the land and letting it return to natural is quite different to finding the economic use for the land. In my opinion. I think what the court was referring to there, and perhaps I used the wrong term, unreasonable, I would be careful about using that word in the future. Perhaps unrealistic might be a better word.
Unrealistic.
Yeah, I mean, I do go on to use unrealistic. Yeah, to focus on the reversible effects of farming. So it's not, you know, I mean, retiring the land for urban development is quite different to retiring the land to let it be absorbed within the greater natural environment.
Thank you. Unrealistic would certainly be more prudent if you were in Judge Jackson's court.
Noted.
You finished the question?
Please.
I had one substantive point, one point of clarification left as is. The first point of clarification, in your summary, an example of this is the interim decision for Claim Change 13. Obviously, we just had the final, but I think there were 12 decisions before that. Which one are you talking about?
That's a good question, because it was quite fun. Decision one.
Oh, that's easy, the first one.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Where are we again?
Paragraph 7 of your...
Paragraph 7?
Yes.
Yeah. So, the interim decision, plan change 13. I do mean decision one. I had a copy of that.
If you could email, if you've got a soft copy, can you email it to the hearing administrator so you need the trouble of downloading?
Of course.
The last question I had was related to Area A.
Am I correct in my reading of your own assessment, or your landscape assessment, that area A is, in your view, more sensitive, more visible than the other two development areas?
Yes.
And I think you used the word special efforts to maintain.
Yes. If I was master planning it, I would be planning it with access from behind the moraine ridge on which it sits. So basically off Starbomb Road, you'd go behind it so that you didn't get a lot of driveways going up there. And that would be important, in my view, to maintain rural character of, you know, the lifestyle zone. It's quite hummocky up there in that landform, and there's definitely places you could fit building platforms, very nice building platforms, without really degrading rural character of that piece of landscape as you view it from particularly this view, the Branston Street that I've highlighted.
And so the question, and it's perhaps a rhetorical question, but the question I'm going to discuss with Mr. Edgar is whether an RL zoning would deliver that outcome. Is that the nub of it?
It is. But again, it goes back to what is the point of that zone in the first place if it isn't to maintain rural character. So surely the controls that are in place would deliver on that.
Touching faith. After see what the rural stream make of all the suspicions they have and whether that's the end result. Any more questions? Thank you very much, Ms. Eads. Your contribution is greatly appreciated.
Thank you.
Mrs. Ed would like to be excused.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Feel free to go around.
Thank you. We've got a nice set program for you.
Many thanks.
And Mr. Edgar.
My name is Scott Hacker. I'm a real estate management planner at Southern Land, and I've been engaged by Hoffenden Limited by expert planning evidence in relation to their submission. The following is a summary of my evidence in chief, which was pre-lodged on this vehicle. The submission of Hoffenden Limited seeks the following: the realignment of the OIL line in relation to Hoffenden Farm, and the rezoning of parts of Hoffenden Farm from rural to rural residential and rural lifestyle. As outlined in my evidence, I consider that the relief sought generally aligns with the provisions of the National Policy Statement on Urban Development Capacity and is generally consistent with the provisions of the Octave and Proposed Regional Policy Statement. I consider that the higher order provisions of the proposed district plan, being the objective policies contained in the Strategic Direction, Urban Development and Landscapes chapters, are appropriate and consider that the release sought is generally consistent with those provisions. With regard to the alignment of the ONL line, I adopt the opinion of Ms. Ayres and the supporting opinions of Mr. Leary with regard to geology, and consider that the ONL line would be more appropriately aligned as set out in the submission, generally following the upper edge of the upper standard. Consequently, I consider that the relief sought in relation to the alignment of the ONL line is the most appropriate means of achieving the objectives of the proposed district plan. With regard to the proposed rezoning of Area A from rural to rural lifestyle, I adopt the opinions of Ms. Melsop and Ms. Ayres that in landscape terms, Area A has the capacity to absorb the likely change that would result from the proposed rezoning, and I consider that the detailed siting of building platforms, landscaping, servicing and access can be appropriately addressed through the subdivision process. Consequently, I consider that the proposed rezoning of Area A as rural lifestyle is appropriate. Similarly, I adopt the opinions of Ms. Melsop and Ms. Ayres that Area B is relatively well contained in landscape terms, and I agree with Ms. Ayres that Area B is appropriate for rural residential zoning. The rural residential and rural lifestyle chapter of the proposed district plan seeks to provide residential living opportunities on the periphery of urban areas, and I consider that the difference in lot size from the proposed rural residential zoning to the adjoining large lot residential zoning, along with a likely difference in character between the two zones, will provide an adequate transition between urban and rural. In terms of Area C, I adopt the opinions of Ms. Melsop and Ms. Ayres and agree with Mr. Barr that Area C is appropriate for rural lifestyle zoning as proposed. Areas A, B and C can be accessed from either end of Southern Road by way of the internal farm road or through the formation of the currently unfarmed section of Southern Road at the time of land or the adjoining large lot residential zone is developed. In addition, I consider that areas A, B and C have scope to be self-sufficient in terms of servicing. The rural residential and rural lifestyle chapter acknowledges that parts of the lands and the zones may be subject to natural hazards, and I consider that areas A, B and C are sufficiently clear of identified hazards such that adverse effects of natural hazards can be appropriately avoided or mitigated through the subdivision process. I consider that the rezoning of areas A, B and C as proposed would contribute to the range of residential opportunities in close proximity to urban Wanaka while appropriately recognising presence of rural activities in the wider area and providing the submitter the ability to better control reverse sensitivity effects on a farming operation. Overall, I consider that the objectives and policies of the proposed district plan as it relate to landscapes, rural living and urban development are the most appropriate means of achieving the purposes of the Act, and that the relief sought is the most appropriate means of achieving those objectives. I consider that the relief sought is consistent with Section 5 of the Act and adequately recognises and provides for the relevant matters of national importance set out in Section 6 and has appropriate regard to the relevant Section 7 matters. I therefore consider that the relief sought by Auckland Unlimited, being the realignment of the ONL line and the rezoning of areas A, B and C as rural residential and rural lifestyle, achieves the purpose of the Act.
Thank you, Mr. Rector. One initial question from me, before I forget this, that just discussed with Ms. Ayres, Area A, and the need for special provisions, special something, to achieve appropriate landscape outcomes. and in effect she passed over to you the question about whether the panel could be confident that those special provisions would actually be able to be achieved under a rural lifestyle zone. Now, just hold that thought in your mind. The thought that occurred to me, if it's really to take as a given your evidence that it does, and to ask you the next question, which is, if all of those things are encompassed within a rural lifestyle zone, what's the practical difference between that and a rural zone to the developer? What is Mr. Hopgood gaining by a rural lifestyle zone if the rural lifestyle development has to meet a series of discretionary tests to achieve an acceptable environmental outcome, and if he doesn't, he doesn't get consent?
I think the rural lifestyle zoning would bring with it an expectation that some form of rural lifestyle development would be appropriate. That development would need to address landscape effects of building location, servicing and access. But given that council's landscape architect and Ms. Melsop and Ms. Ayres are in agreement that from a landscape perspective that zoning is appropriate, I think that an appropriate outcome could be achieved, and that the expectation that rural lifestyle development could occur wouldn't be unreasonable or unrealistic.
I suppose at that point I suggest to you that both Ms. Melsop and Ms. Ayres were trespassing on your sphere. They can tell us whether a rural lifestyle development will have acceptable or unacceptable outcomes in their opinion from a landscape perspective, but they can't tell us, well, not if they remain true to their commitment to the Environment Court Code, that zoning will have that effect. And I don't mean to criticise them. It's an easy step for an expert to take to move from their sphere of expertise into the plan. But I suppose my point is that that's your sphere, Mr. Barr's sphere. Mm-hmm. So if you step back, and please don't rely on their view as to the adequacy of the plan provisions. I want your view.
I rely on their view in terms of the appropriateness from a landscape perspective, and acknowledge the fact that they consider that there's that care would be required. It's my own opinion that the provisions of the rural residential zone will adequately be able to achieve appropriate outcomes through positioning of building platforms, servicing and routing, rather than relying on the landscape architect's opinions that might occur.
previous answer, the difference in your mind is the expectation that an RL development in some way, shape or form should be able to proceed on that land. Some more questions to pass over to you, Commissioner. So just followed by nose. Right. Before I forgot,
I'll continue on that line of questioning, Mr. Rickey, because you do talk about this in paragraphs 58 to 62, and you describe the purpose of the sort of lifestyle zone, paragraph 59. Paragraph 60, you go through some of the objectives and policies. That's great if we're talking about a discretion on non-compliant activity resource specification, but it doesn't help us understand activities in the zone like provided permitted activities or controlled activities or restricted discretion activities where there was a discretion to so wholesomely go through the objectives and policies that you've identified. So I would be really interested if there were any actual methods in the zone that you think are going to be helpful, rather than just the framework of objectives and policies. So can you identify them for us?
The requirement to identify building platforms, I think, is key.
And that requirement is based on a landscape assessment or another assessment?
Engineering. Sorry?
For instance, is the building platform requirement based on hazard mitigation, which might not relate to landscape issues?
It may be influenced by natural hazards and avoiding those hazards.
Building platforms, yep.
Yep. Beyond that, and the objective policies of the rural lifestyle zone, there's perhaps not much in the way of specific direction.
So how could the council ensure a road access up the back, as Ms. Ayres said she would support? Now, how could the council make all that happen?
My expectation is that would happen through the consent process, in terms of council assessing the layout, the access arrangements, and determining whether they're appropriate.
So, is there a specific method you can identify that explains to us the landscape-based discretion or tool or prompt that would allow a council planner, other than just turning up and saying, I read the policies and I think X, that I'm sure you've experienced, doesn't always go far when an applicant might have councillors experienced and talented as we have here in this room. So, what in the plan would create the clear expectation for everyone that the road would be designed or road that would be designed to take into account the landscape sensitivities we've been told exist on, certainly site A?
Yeah. I suppose it depends on whether we're dealing with a discretionary or restricted discretionary activity.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
It's obviously
New Zealand.
Well, under the plan as notified, it would be a discretionary activity. Under the amended version of the subdivision chapter, it would be restricted discretionary. But potential discretion does extend to landscape effects and servicing and access.
And just continuing that, and if it's a controlled activity, is about 300 submitters sort.
Yeah, if it was a controlled activity, then council would struggle more to exercise as much control.
Well, where I was going to get to, which I think that particular question from the chair took you to, is one of the things we'll need to find a way to work through is, given that the provisions that will apply to the zone are in flux, it may be that there are some scenarios, such as a controlled activity subdivision, that could mean that suddenly the reliability of the zone diminishes such that it wouldn't be supported. So are you able to give us any idea of, are there any clear planning parameters based on your analysis that you would no longer seek the zoning proposed on either or all of areas A, B and C?
I would expect that under a controlled activity regime, the last group architects may be less comfortable with the rezoning from a landscape perspective.
Certainly, Area A, I think.
So, if that were the case or on that assumption, I would say that possibly Area A may not be appropriate under a
controlled activity subdivision.
Well,
that is very helpful, just with this help, whatever communication there is between the various panels here.
I think areas B and C are less sensitive in that regard.
Turning to B and C, my next question for you, in planning terms, what, in your view, are the main reasons why different zones being sought for the two sites? We've been told by landscapers they're very hard to see into, they're quite self-contained, they're very close to the overgrowth boundary or wherever you're doing it.
The Area C, we arrived at the proposed rural lifestyle zoning based on the established character of the land further to the south, and the fact that it is perhaps more open and visible from the formed section of Studholm Road, the southern formed section of Studholm Road. Area B is better contained in terms of visibility, and it was felt that it could accommodate a high density of development while still retaining some rural character and without degrading the rural character of the wider area.
Yeah, well, certainly the submission is limited by scope, so clearly one can't go for more intensity of the sort, but on our site visit, it struck me that there were possibly very large parts of Area C that would be just as much hidden from any view as Site B. And it has been puzzling me why, not eggs in one basket, but why a possibly higher zoning that might be even more efficient was being so limited. But it's effectively about the character of fitting in with at least part of the edge of Site C. Okay. Where I want to go with you now is the NPS. Partly because your client has generously made you available for so much time, so I can actually have a good conversation with someone about it.
I have had these discussions, by the way, with the council plans too.
So you shouldn't feel you're being picked on.
But I do want a non-council position. Do you have a list here?
Yes.
Wonderful. So the starting point for me was, if we go to your evidence in paragraph So I think what you do in paragraph 41 is effectively summarise what the community has to say about things. And it's the nub of an issue I'm trying to work through myself. The NPS requires that capacity is supported by infrastructure. But then you go on to say that there's no understanding or certainty of any infrastructure for these sites, but nonetheless you think the NPS is being addressed if it explicitly says infrastructure has to be catered for. So how do we get to consistency with an NPS requiring some infrastructure certainty in the absence of any infrastructure certainty? So talk me through that.
So the NPS is focused on urban development. In my evidence, I discussed the definition of the urban environment and that I consider that, in this case, the urban environment includes urban Wanaka and the areas around urban Wanaka.
Yeah, what you did is you substituted what the NPS says on urban environment for what the district plan says on urban development, which I don't think counts. So I want to take you to the NPS definition of urban environment, which is what the NPS applies to. And perhaps unhelpfully, that's on page 8 of the NPS. In fact, if there's anything involving 2,000 people or more, it doesn't really tell us anything about urban zones, rural zones, urban growth boundaries or anything.
Mm.
And so I wanted to put to you that if we felt we couldn't agree with what you've done, which is substituting the PDP trigger, and therefore we did have to say that possible capacity, even in a rural zone, had to somehow satisfy what the NPS says about infrastructure, what do we do? And I'll be frank with you, one of the issues I've got with it is that it seems to make it very hard, perhaps unintentionally, for submitters to bring capacity to the table for a plan change, for a council to say, but we haven't got it in an LCP, so therefore it can't possibly meet the NPS. That's not what the council's doing, but it seems that is one logical conclusion to at least some of the arguments we've heard.
Yes,
that's the issue I'm struggling with.
Does seem to be a chicken and egg situation. I think, on the strict reading of the policies in the NPS, they talk about the availability of development infrastructure, and that's defined in the NPS as network infrastructure for water supply, wastewater, stormwater, and land transport, to the extent it's controlled by local authorities. So in that sense, the NPS doesn't really provide for or address alternative solutions.
I think you've identified a little loophole in fairness and your evidence, where you talk about, at least in respect of water and wastewater, rural density development can usually be self-sufficient off-grid. So there could be an argument that actually makes it harder for people wanting an urban zone, without having that network gateway, but it could be that, in respect of at least, I'll pop the stormwater too, the three waters of rural density development could probably say the NPS can be argued to have been met because there is no demand being generated if it's self-sufficient.
Mm.
That sound reasonable?
Yeah.
So that would then just leave the issue of roads. And what we heard when we spoke to Mr. Glasner and the banks, the council witnesses on infrastructure and credit, they had concerns with public road upgrades that had not been identified in an LTP and for which development contributions could not be exacted. Sorry if I'm leading you here, I'm just trying to work through something I've been thinking about for a week and a half now. But they seem to be reasonably comfortable with the proposition of developers effectively providing their own road solutions, which typically happens within a subdivision. But it's things like, do little bits of stuff on road, for instance, need to be upgraded too. And what I want to put to you is, in the context of a rural zone submission, as we have here, and for the purpose of the NPS, a submitter
could say, well, the three waters could be taken care of without needing any network infrastructure grid. And as part of the submission, a developer or an submitter proposed or even suggested methods within a plan that specified developers had to provide roading. Would that be the scenario that, in your view, could satisfy what the NPS effectively is saying, that to get a zone you've got to have some infrastructure solution?
Mm. Yeah, I think that would be a reasonable approach, and the subdivision chapter does include requirements in terms of servicing and access.
Yeah, on that, just so you, again, you're in the loop on the conversation we had with the council witnesses, they, through Mr. Barr, expressed the view that while there are subdivision restrictions proposed by the council that talk about roading and access and infrastructure, their view, and I think the chair said this morning as well, that their view was that was intended to be much more focused on the detail of a site rather than yes, go, yes, no, gateway, is there infrastructure or not?
Yeah.
Is that how you read those restrictions?
That's not how I read them, and my experience has been that it's not unusual for when land is subdivided for there to be works to upgrade roads beyond the boundaries of the site, whether it be the upgrading of an intersection or I guess an example would be the other day we were talking about the Kiramoku Crescent and the Kiramoku Block. If you drive around Kiramoku Crescent, one side of the road has been widened and well, not urban channel, but vehicle crossing swales and some road widening has been carried out by the developer on one side of the road, the same treatment would be expected on the other side of the road when the adjoining land is developed. So I don't think it's unusual for developers to have to carry out works to facilitate subdivision.
Given that the proposed restrictions, as certainly as you've read them, seem to be open-ended rather than closed-ended as it relates to which transport and which infrastructure the council could refuse consent for, would it be, in your view, a matter that fell within the legal powers of a consent authority to make clarifications to plan provisions to be clear what was intended at the detail level within a site itself, and whether there needed to be a clarification that if road infrastructure or other network infrastructure possibly needed to be upgraded to serve as a subdivision, it would be at the developer's cost, but unless they waited for an LGA type process or something like that. Would you think that's just pushing it too far, or do you think that kind of clarification is A, within the spirit of the NPS, and B, otherwise appropriate?
Yes, I think it is, although in this case we're talking about rezoning land outside of the urban growth boundary.
We are for your client. But I'm also addressing you more generally on the issue of submissions that have come in with an NPS that says you need to have infrastructure at face value. And I'm asking you as a professional planner to give me assistance across the board as much as specifically relating to the rural-based zoning of this particular submission you're here for today.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard not to make the distinction between urban and rural. I think in that.
Yeah, that's fine. It may well be that you can see a gateway that only applies to the rural zones.
Mm.
That's your view.
Yeah. I think in the urban zones or within the urban growth boundary, it would be less in the spirit of the NPS to require developers to provide for those infrastructure upgrades beyond the boundaries of
the fact it could lead to the council suddenly putting less projects in its LCP. Precisely as a knock-on from that, couldn't it? Okay, look, I think we might be taking it as far as we can, and so I'll stop there.
Can I take up the cudgels? Because there is an element in your chain of reasoning relating to the NPS that I need to draw to your attention. You relied on the purposes of your reasoning on the definition of urban development in the PDP, which was in turn subject of much discussion about 14 months ago at the hearing on the strategic chapters, where I put to council or the council that the existing definition was unintelligible, supported by Judge Jackson's view to the same effect in relation to the Arrowtown urban growth boundary, which in the fullness of time resulted in a recommendation from council staff that the definition be changed to what I would colloquially call a duck type definition. If it looks like urban development, and it waddles like urban development, and it squawks like urban development, it probably is. Now, assuming, and of course we can only assume at that point, assuming that hearing panel were minded to accept the council's recommendation that an amended definition of urban development was required along those lines, what would that do to your reasoning about the application of the NPS beyond the urban growth boundary?
It does make it more difficult. It does seem to me to create a bit of a contradiction in terms of having rural living zones, which by definition in the plan are or can be considered urban.
It's a bit tough when I throw a big curveball at you based on the hearing you haven't been at, so I appreciate that you doing your best to respond.
I think Mr. Barr included the amended wording definition in his rebuttal evidence, so I didn't have a read of it, but perhaps I need to give it some more thought in the context of the NPS.
contaminant of your reasoning. But I wondered if I was being unduly picky to detect a contradiction, internal contradiction. So I'll put it to you. Paragraph 67. You're here discussing that the strategic objectives of the plan, as notified, require that development within the UGB provides a sensitive transition from urban to rural. Is that consistent with your suggestion that a rural residential zone immediately on the other side of the UGB would provide a transition to rural?
Yeah. I think the requirement to provide a transition from urban to rural applies on both sides as an urban growth boundary. Generally, you have your high density residential, medium density, low density, then large lot residential as you move outwards from the town centre, with the large lot residential being located generally around the edge of the urban growth boundary, and then the rural residential and rural lifestyle chapter directs that type of development to the periphery of urban areas. So I think that there's a requirement to have regard to the transition on either side of the urban growth boundary, not just the on the rural side of the urban growth boundary.
Well, I should tell you that the thought that occurred to me when I read your reasoning is that you put your finger on an inconsistency between the strategic chapters and the provisions of chapter 22 that supposedly reflect and give effect to the strategic chapters. Now we're not, obviously that's a long way from what we're currently considering, but do you have a view, like Commissioner Munro, I'm interested in your view as to whether there is an issue, whether there is an inconsistency? And I had a place where it wouldn't be the only one on the plan.
I think to comment on whether there's an inconsistency or not, I'd need to have a careful reread of the strategic direction and urban development chapters. I do recall some discussion in the large lot residential chapter relating to the transition between urban and rural, and then, as I set out in my evidence, there's objectives and policies in the rural residential and rural lifestyle chapter that require that the or seek to ensure that the integrity of the urban rural edge is maintained. So
yes, I appreciate it's a bit curveball that I've thrown in your direction.
Yeah.
We'll leave it there. Something that I've just got to ponder. Two final questions from me. So we've got the first is in relation to your paragraph 84. You're here discussing the use of the subdivision process for roading upgrades. The specific issue that Ms. Banks discusses is the potential for cumulative adverse effects on the roading network. And the question is this, are the subdivision chapters going to be able to pick that up on an individual consent application, or is this always like the classic cumulative problem where everybody says, I'm only having a microscopic effect, don't pick on me?
In terms of the cumulative effect, my recollection is that Ms. Banks is talking about cumulative effects in terms of road safety.
Yes.
I think council has the ability to require works within the road to facilitate the subdivision, whether that be widening or intersection upgrades or whatever it may be. Once the land is rezoned, it may be difficult to address specific road safety issues. In the sense that if a road is particularly unsafe, in its formation or its alignment, then it may be difficult to require a developer to carry out works, significant works, to, you know, fully realign a road to address a particular corner that was problematic. I haven't had the benefit of a traffic assessment, other than Ms. Banks' assessment, to support the rezoning. But certainly the southern stretch of Studholme Road appears to me to be relatively straight and flat, and there's scope within the road reserve to carry out any widening that might be required. So while the rezoning and subdivision of the land may cause cumulative, or could potentially cause cumulative effects on road safety as the road currently stands, I think there's scope to address other. Those issues would likely be addressed through road widening, acknowledging that I'm not a traffic engineer.
And the last point, in the same page, and it may be a little unfair, but I'll put it to you anyway. You can tell me that I am being unfair. That I read your reasoning, paragraph 87, that about natural hazards, saying much of urban Wanaka in the areas subject to the same hazards, and thought went through my mind, is it really an answer to say the hazards are no worse than the areas that have already been developed?
It wasn't so much relying, or wasn't so much relying on what's gone before to justify justify what is proposed. I was pointing out that there is a large part of urban Wanaka is susceptible to natural hazards, and the areas of Auckland's environment have been selected for rezoning are generally clear of the identified hazards. There are parts of alluvial fan hazards that project into those areas a little bit, but in the context of what's already occurred in that vicinity, I think the natural hazard risk would be less, given that the areas to be rezoned are located outside of those identified, or generally outside of those identified hazard areas. The exception being liquefaction, but it's shown as nil to low hazard, so it's not, in my understanding, a hazard that would cause problems for development.
And to be fair, I should also tell you, I asked Mr. Barr, and it's a very general question, whether, given that the whole district seems to be subject to natural hazards to some greater or lesser extent, whether there were any showstoppers on the hazard front for any of the applications, and he didn't identify this one.
Yeah. And I think the rural residential and rural lifestyle zoning, and the rural lifestyle in particular, does with the minimum lot size of 1 hectare and average lot size of 2 hectares, does provide or encourage flexible design, which can avoid areas that may be more susceptible to natural hazards.
You've got, basically, you've just got more room to play.
Yeah.
That's all I have. It's traversed all the questions I have. Right. That's it from us. Thank you very much, Mr. Ed, for your assistance. Mr. Withdall, I'm not inviting you to make any closing comments. That hasn't been the process, but if you feel the need, now would be the time.
I would like to make a very quick point in relation to ONL only, and really to try and encapsulate the issue. And there are a number of ways it can be expressed. One of them is, does putting the ONL boundary across the Orpenden farm promote or advance the objective of the Act in protecting areas, and this area, I'm talking about Mount Alpha, ONL, from inappropriate subdivision use and development, etc. You can turn it around the other way and say, does putting the boundary where we say it should be detract from that objective of the Act? Does it detract from the coherence, integrity, and aesthetic value of the ONL behind it? Nobody has suggested that it does. Nobody has suggested that it's necessary to have a lower boundary in order to promote that objective of the Act. If it's not necessary, what is the purpose of doing it? Because all that you're going to achieve is impose a level of bureaucratic hurdles on a landowner without advancing the purposes of the Act and the purposes of the district plan. And that's really it.
Nothing for me. Thank you for the attendance of you and your team. It's very much appreciated.
Thank you.
To allow the person of the team to quietly vacate the room.